You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. 2 years after the 2016 presidential election, we are still learning the details about Russia's disinformation and manipulation campaigns. To help us understand what happened and the role that tech companies, our government, and we as citizens played in the security of our elections and need to play in the security of our elections, I'm speaking today with Alex Stamos. Up until recently, he was Facebook's chief security officer and has now joined our team at FSI as the William J. Perry Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation. Alex, welcome to the program, and by the way, welcome to Stanford once again.
Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here.
Hard for a Berkeley guy to be around here, right?
Yeah, was there a football game this month?
There was.
I'm not sure there was.
There was. I'm glad you watched. I did. But really, it's great to have you here. Such an important set of questions that we at Stanford and we as a country, I think, are still trying to figure out the right way to talk about them. But let's talk about some history. Let's talk about what it was like in real time. As we were learning, at least I remember it, watching in real time, as we began to understand that there was a Russian campaign to try to influence the outcome of the election. Go back in time. Tell us what it felt like when you're sitting at Facebook and you begin to see some things that happened broadly, but also things that happened within your own company that the Russians did.
So I started at Facebook in June of 2015. And at the time, we had two big areas of focus in kind of the geopolitical area for cybersecurity. The first was in the use of the platform by ISIS. And that was a big part of, you know, a lot of people were talking about the responsibility of tech companies to keep our platforms from being used as both a tool of propaganda and a tool of recruiting.
Right.
And that was really one of the first things that I had to kind of focus on when I got there.
And they
there.
Were good at it, right? Just to remind our listeners?
Quite good. And ISIS was unique among the terrorist threats that the United States has faced in that it had this large, what we called jihadist population.
Jihadist.
Yes.
Never heard that word before.
Right. Okay. Of mostly of young, millennial, technologically advanced, mostly young Muslim men who were in the United States and in Europe who were able to support the technical goals of ISIS. They're the ones who are helping create propaganda and such. So that was one area of focus. For nation states like Russia, we had a dedicated team that I inherited from my predecessor and then was able to grow that looked at the use of Facebook to attack individuals. And so when we were thinking about what were Russia and China and other U.S. adversaries doing, we were looking for traditional cybersecurity attacks. So this would be – I might – spearfish a person who works for the military of in the United States or another Western nation, get them to have malware on their computer. I might steal their credentials so I can read their Facebook information. And that's, you know, we had dedicated people looking at Russia. We had one guy who all he did mostly was Russian track Russian adversaries. He had done the same thing for the U.S. government
and, right?
in the intelligence community. So his entire career, he had been tracking these guys.
And what does just as a sidebar, what does that look like in a day to day? Like, what is he actually physically doing to track the Russians?
So that's a great question. So as a tech platform, we don't have access to all these things the intelligence community has, right?
Right.
So they have Intercept, SIGINT, they have the legal and technical capability to actually break into computers used by adversary nations.
Right.
We don't have that.
Right.
What we have is the interactions with our products by people who we believe work for adversary intelligence services. And what they will do is they will create accounts and personas whose entire job it is to first do reconnaissance against potential targets, to then build relationships with them, to groom them, and then eventually—
All online, right?
All just online, on possibly totally on Facebook,
right?
Sometimes between Facebook and other products, which
right.
is having relationship then with the other companies is really important.
Okay.
And they will build up these relationships, build these personas, and then use it traditionally to deliver some kind of payload, a spear phishing attack, a piece of malware, convince them to do something. So for example, we shut down many of these campaigns. One of the ones I can probably talk about because it ended up leaking to the New York Times, not from
right.
us, but from the State Department,
okay.
is our team detected the Iranian Revolutionary Guard using Facebook to spear phish employees at the State Department, taking over their accounts, and then trying to use that to find people in Iran who were friends with people in the State Department and other U.S. groups.
Oh, I see.
So they were doing their own domestic counterintelligence right. against dissidents inside of Iran.
And using the State Department.
Yeah.
You would want to know those contacts if you were them, right? I see.
Okay. Yeah. And unfortunately, there's a bunch of thoughtful, you know, dedicated public servants, young people who love you, social media, and who would list United States State Department in their Facebook profile and then would fall for these tricks of people saying like, hey, I saw you at this conference, or I met right. you in, you know, I work at in Foggy Bottom as well, and I right. saw you in the cafeteria. And they'd fall for it, and eventually their accounts would be taken over, and that would provide them with the capability of finding Iranian dissidents.
Wow.
So that's like the kind of thing that our team detected, okay. looking at this behavior, and then turned over to them, told the State Department, and helped them and the FBI deal with the aftermath. So that's what we were doing. In real time in 2016, that team spotted some reconnaissance activity by accounts that we had thought were tied to APT-28, which is the AKA SOFACY, which is one of the offensive units of GRU, which okay. I don't have to explain to you, but for our listeners,
explain to the listeners all this.
The main intelligence yeah. directorate of the actual Russian military. I don't know right. if there's anything else you want to add from your experience.
No, but when you say reconnaissance mission, again, explain that to our listeners. Like, what are they doing? They're out there. Well, just explain it. Like, what does that mean? Look like?
Right. So let's say you work for an intel agency, and your job is you need to get the email of this particular person in the United States.
Okay.
One of the things you're going to do is you're going to try to build a profile of all of their online accounts, right? So
okay.
let's say John Podesta, he was one of the targets of
right.
the GRU. And so what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to find his LinkedIn account and his Facebook account. You're going to want to create an account on Facebook that perhaps can friend him or friend one of his friends. It gives you more information about him.
Okay.
You're going to try to see who his friends are, see what you can gather about what email addresses he used, what his phone number is. Build like an online profile so then you can come up with an approach of how you're going to try to get to his account.
I see.
And so for
that's
us.
That's what reconnaissance right, virtually looks like.
Yeah. And for us, reconnaissance in this case looks like people searching for who works for the DCCC, who works for the DNC, going looking
These
up their
parts
information.
Of the Democratic Party organizations.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And in this case, their actual activity was not malicious, but we had been able to tie these accounts to activity against like the World Anti-Doping Agency, against Ukrainian military targets. And so we had a pretty strong understanding
of who they were.
Yes, of who they were.
And this is all on Facebook.
This was on Facebook.
Right? Okay.
Now, the next step doesn't happen on Facebook. So we see some of this reconnaissance.
Okay.
We notify our contacts in the U.S. law enforcement who work.
So you did. That was one of my questions. So you yeah. were in direct contact with them in real time when you right. saw this activity.
And you know, on these traditional cyber threats, there was actually a good working relationship between the tech companies and the FBI. The FBI has created these specialists who coordinate on specific threat actors,
okay.
and they often have relationships with people in the tech companies who have some of this information that isn't available to the government.
Right.
And so we do that, but they kind of disappear from our radar. And it turns out their actual offensive operations happen off of Facebook. So
okay.
they're against Gmail. They're against the DNC servers.
Right.
What
happened, right?
And that happens in the summer.
And it was in Gmail, right?
Yeah.
Just to remind our listeners.
Yes. It's right. Like the DNC servers were servers that they're hosting themselves, which is actually a huge mistake. Effectively, nobody is qualified to run email servers against Russian intel
I did not
attackers.
Know that.
Yeah.
I thought I knew this story well. That's the first time I realized that.
Yeah. So
they had their own servers.
Yeah. They're running their own Microsoft Exchange system, which they're just not qualified to do against this kind of adversary.
Right.
Right. Here at Stanford, we use Microsoft Office 365
right.
and some people use Google. That's the way to do it.
Right. right.
And that's actually what the DNC does now.
Right.
And so that happens off of Facebook. Later in the summer, what happened is once they had gathered up all this information from the DNC, Podesta, other people they hacked, their professionals look, they build their strategy and they plant these emails with accompanying stories with a number of journalists
right.
and push these messages about that Hillary had rigged the election, the primary election against Bernie Sanders.
Right.
That was what they really wanted to push. And they had created these personas for something called DC Leaks. So they had created their own WikiLeaks, completely in-house. I think WikiLeaks is probably at a minimum, a useful idiot for them.
Okay.
But perhaps not under complete control. And so they wanted their own. And so they create this DC Leaks persona and a bunch of people that are tied to it. We were able to tie that back to the GRU accounts. Once DC Leaks became active and started dumping some of this stuff out, we shut them down. But for the most part, that activity had very little to do with Facebook. That
right.
was mostly about playing stuff with the media.
Right.
Unbeknownst to us, there was a whole nother set of activity that then we discovered in the spring and summer of 2017.
Right.
And that was activity by the Internet Research Agency and right. other Russian troll groups. And that activity was completely different in that there was no hacking at all, right?
Right.
Those groups were just creating, you know, finding fault lines in American society and trying to amplify them. And they would create these personas that were heightened kind of caricatures of what legitimate American activists in different areas would say. So
give an example just to make it clear to.
Yeah. So for example, they created both a pro-Black Lives Matter group and a pro-police group, both putatively based in Baltimore. And they used advertising on Facebook to find people who were open to those messages.
Okay.
And so they would target, if you're a pro Black Lives Matter group, they would use that group and they would advertise targeting people who lived in the inner city, probably younger men. You can't specifically target racial groups on Facebook, but you can find proxies that allow you to do that. And then the pro-police group in the suburbs.
Okay. Right?
And then they would reference each other directly as well as push all these really extreme messages on one side or the other. And their goal was to get then people, the kind of true believers that they found via advertising, to get those true believers to reshare this content. And it's from that way that they were first able to build an audience around 3 to 4 million people who decided they wanted to see this content. Those are people who liked or followed these pages.
Okay.
But then those 4 million people reshared out to about 130 million people.
So that's how we get to that number.
And that's how you get to that big number, is effectively the crazy Uncle Sal problem, right?
Right.
Like everybody's got that cousin or uncle on Facebook that'll share anything. They found those people and sucked them into these groups, making them believe. And nihilistically, you know, pretty sure the police or the Russians don't actually care about Black Lives Matter. They don't care about police brutality.
Right.
They just see it as a real movement that they can draft behind and use to amplify division in American society. And so that's something that was going on during this time that we were not aware of and didn't find until the spring and summer.
Right. So you found it after the elections, just
after
to be
the election,
clear. I think that's there's some confusion about that among people talking about what happened on the platform.
Yeah.
On Facebook, I mean. Just to be clear, was all of the activity on Facebook about issues like this, or was it also direct, what would look like more direct campaign support for a candidate, Trump?
It was a mix for the troll activity.
Okay, to explain the difference.
Right.
Yes,
so
that's a good point.
The
right.
GRU activity, hyper laser focused on hurting Hillary Clinton. I personally don't believe that they thought Trump was going to win. I don't think
nobody thought Trump was going to win. Trump didn't think Trump was going to win.
Right, so. That's pretty clear. Michael Cohen certainly that was not planning on that.
Yes.
I don't think the Russians are better than Nate Silver, right?
Uh-huh.
I think they thought Hillary was going to win and they wanted to weaken her future administration as much as possible.
Right.
And therefore, you know, weaken the United States. So the GRU activity, but that activity was mostly not on Facebook. Of the activity on Facebook, the troll activity, the IRA and such, we had an estimate that 80 to 90% of it was not electioneering. So actually did not fall within the U.S. definition of campaign ads.
Right.
Now, those definitions are quite tight and have been limited by things like Citizens United.
Right.
Right. Effectively, you have to say vote for this for or against this person or specifically mention a candidate. Most of them did not specifically mention candidates. The activity started well before the election. It lasted after the election.
Right.
But the election clearly was one of the things in mind. In both the issue ads and in the small percentage of it that directly mentioned a candidate.
I want to bring in some other actors, if we have time, about what the government did or did not do and what the media did. But just briefly on this piece, now that you've seen this, obviously, you know, you were instrumental, you were part of this all. Had you known about this activity, like, say, in the summer of 2016, would there have been things you would have done differently?
I definitely think so. I think there's both. The responses to this activity break into two categories. There's the operational responses, which is you could go find these accounts, find these actors, shut them down. That is a responsive action.
Right.
You generally cannot do that until they've done the bad thing,
but you
can limit their spread. There's also product responses, which is you can redesign how the product works.
Okay.
And I think if we had had a better understanding of what was going on in 2016, you could have had both of operational and product responses. Probably more operational because going and finding stuff, you don't have to do a lot of development. Those are just people using existing tools, shutting them down, making the decision to shut them down. It does take
And you're not worried about First Amendment issues when you say that?
Well, that
– I'm sure you are, but that's why I
am.
Yeah, right. That's why
And that is like a key issue that I think slowed down Facebook and the other tech companies' response
okay.
is that traditionally in most of the kinds of abuses of the platforms that we've dealt with, there's not a lot of free expression argument for the content, right?
Right.
If people are doing things that harm children, not a lot of people are going to argue that there's a legitimate free speech issue.
Great
there.
Point.
But in this case, one, the individual action is not against any rules. You are allowed to create a social media account and say, I think Texas should leave the union, right? I think we need to have less immigration. You are allowed to do that as long as you're within, you know, hate speech boundaries and such.
Right.
What you're not allowed to do is for 500 people to pretend to be 1,000 people and to pretend to be living in Wyoming when they're actually living in St. Petersburg.
Right.
That is not allowed. But that kind of collective behavior is much harder both to define from a policy perspective
right.
and a lot harder technically defined than like somebody doing one specific thing to harm a child or
right.
delivering a piece of malware where the specific action is bad and you can build software to find the specific action. The other challenge is that when you shut this content down, you are by nature defining who is a legitimate political speaker on these platforms. That's a big decision, and one that the company's never had to deal with before.
Right.
Right? They've created these hate speech policies and other policies that are often focused on safety of individuals. But you can do that based upon an existing set of laws in the United States and other Western nations, and you can do so in a rather content-neutral way. Extremely difficult to be content-neutral when you're dealing with trolls like this, especially
right.
when much of their content is on one side or the other. And I think that really did slow down and paralyze the companies to a certain extent because they just don't want to be in that position. And you see now, you know, just this week, the CEO of Google was in front of the House, and you have both Democrats and Republicans complaining that Google search results are biased against them.
Yes.
I don't think Google search results are biased against either
right.
side. But I do believe what's happened is the companies have – now that they're making these definitions, they have set themselves up as the referees. And just like with a football game, working the refs is a totally legitimate practical strategy.
That's right. Let's come back to – in fact, we're going to keep on the diagnostics today, and then we're going to invite you back to talk about prescriptions because we're going to run out of time. So what about the government's role in 2016? So obviously, we know now that they were aware of a lot of this activity we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking with the FBI. When you look back on it retrospectively, should they have been more vocal in talking about what they knew, and or was that also pretty difficult to do?
I think there are multiple very powerful actors here, specifically the Obama administration and the tech companies, also, you know, mostly Facebook, who thought that Hillary is going to win.
Right.
Two, had a lot of people who wanted Hillary to win and allowed those two facts to change how they reacted to this issue.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
Okay.
And
explain that.
Well, so you have effectively heard that from Comey, right, himself, that like, you know, now knowing what he knows, that he would make different decisions.
Right.
I think it's pretty clear to external observers that decisions the FBI made and the Obama administration made, that they really did not want to be seen as putting their fingers on the scale.
Right.
So in a situation where the FBI might have been much more aggressive about both public attribution and warning of potential victims, they did neither. That
right.
there was very little public discussion of this. And while they were sitting on a bunch of information, they did not do a good job of helping the DNC protect themselves.
Right.
And I think you could probably put a lot of that on the administration did not want to be seen as helping a candidate from their own
candidate.
Party.
Right, of
and
course.
I think you had the same thing at the tech companies, where the truth is the of the top two levels of these companies, the majority of them are Democrats. A number
okay.
of them are like massive Democratic donors. And they're very sensitive about the idea that they're going to be seen by half the country as just being on Team Blue.
Uh-huh.
Right. And
uh-huh.
I do think that there's a number of decisions made to stay neutral, where neutrality itself was turned out to not be neutral
right.
itself.
But they didn't know that at the time.
But they right? didn't know
at
the time.
That's your point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I do think the government missed an opportunity here. I think there's also probably a blind spot in the government, just like there was in the companies, which makes sense because you're talking about the same population of people,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of these folks go to the government, they get good training, they end up coming out of NSA, coming out of Cyber Command, working for private companies. They've been trained at NSA of what is a cyber actor for a U.S. adversary. That traditionally has not included these pure propaganda groups.
Right.
And so within the USIC, within the big tech companies, within the ecosystem of cybersecurity companies, so this is the Mandiant, the CrowdStrikes, the people that help us understand these actors, write reports, do intelligence sharing, none of that group was tracking the Internet Research Agency, right?
Because
this is like a pure propaganda group, no hackers, no direct relationship to a Russian intelligence community. I think there was just actually a blind spot for all of us that none of us were paying attention to these guys.
Yeah, that most certainly is my impression talking to people in the Obama administration as part of, you know, explanation, not excuse, but a big blind spot. Let's add one more actor here before we close. I've heard you talk about it before, and that's the media itself and how they were reporting on this stuff. Give me your take.
I think that's another actor that made decisions with the assumption that Hillary's going to win. And you have a lot of people kind of in the mainstream center-left media who are almost certainly more Hillary fans than Trump fans. Even if some of them are soft Republicans, a lot of them were never Trumpers.
Right.
And were being very careful to look even-handed. And so they end up, even without the Russian activity, emphasizing a number of Hillary's faults at the same level of the, you know, manifest obvious issues with Donald Trump and his campaign, but then specifically ended up getting played by the GRU. When they, you know this as well as anybody, if something happens completely out in the open, it's often not considered a scandal, right? But if something is in a secret email and it's leaked or stolen, then the exact same statement can become a scandalous statement.
Right.
And so
that's a great point.
The GRU knew this. They knew that if they could back up a story about Hillary Clinton with emails that were hacked from the DNC, that the media could not resist covering it as a scandal.
Right.
And they exploited that, and they were able to generate thousands of newspaper stories, hundreds of hours of cable news coverage, and a bunch of stuff on social media. But honestly, to block Russian propaganda during 2016, really Facebook would have had to block the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. And that was certainly not something that the companies are going to do.
Right.
And I do think it is absolutely true that tech companies have failed in a lot of ways. I think a lot, though, there's a lot of misplaced rage by the mainstream media against tech companies that is partially because they have not dealt with their own failings in 2016.
Right.
And they want to push this to the new guys in the tech world. And they, you know, they're not writing stories about their editorial decisions. You don't see on the front page of the New York Times a discussion of arguments inside the New York Times editorial room in 2016.
Well, that's a good
but
point.
Those decisions were also critical. And at some point, the media is going to have to deal with that, because of all of the things that have changed since 2016, probably the thing that's changed the least is that if today Russian government dumped out a bunch of emails for somebody they don't like in Congress, would the media treat it any differently, or would they cover it in exactly the same way? And it doesn't matter if in the eighth paragraph you say we're being manipulated as part of an information operation, people read the headlines. And I think that is still continues to be a massive weakness, because there hasn't been a reckoning of how should the media deal with strategic leaks on behalf of U.S. adversaries.
The norm, the discussion, let alone like what are the rules of the road. So it sounds like we've got a lot of work to do before 2020.
Yeah, it feels like it. Yeah.
Well, maybe let's take our next time. Let's get you back here and talk about those and what kind of things, especially with the new Congress, especially with the opportunity maybe to do some of these new things now that the balance has changed there. Let's invite you back and talk about prescriptions.
Absolutely. You know, I always sound very negative when talking about this, but I think there's a lot we can do. But we have to start now if we want to be ready for 2020.
Right. Now's the moment. Alex, thanks a lot for being on World Class.
Thanks, Mike, for having me and for having me here at Stanford.
It's great to have you here. You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.